Like we met at the Graham Hancock Conference in Sedona a few weeks ago, and you had your wares laid out, your alpaca goods laid out, and I passed by and we struck up conversations and got into all kinds of stuff. But the whole drive back to Colorado, I was thinking, this is so interesting what you do, not just the products, but like your whole lifestyle that you've chosen. And I thought, this is really, I want to learn more. And so I'm just glad that you were able, I appreciate you coming on and talking about this. But just to kind of backtrack a little bit, because you and I already know this, but we talked, I thought I'd do a quick intro for you and then you can add in whatever I miss here, but just so listeners can understand where we're coming from. So I got this off your website in 2021. You and your husband Dave founded an off-grid 47-acre alpaca farm 15 miles down a dirt road in a remote corner of Arizona. Your farm operates sustainably, harvesting solar energy, collecting rainwater. As we were talking earlier, you don't even have a well, and you manage all your waste on site. You have a herd of 70 alpaca and 20 sheep. What else would you like folks to know before we get into some of the specifics?
I mean, that sounds pretty good. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. A little bit more of a backstory would just be that it complicates things. So I don't know if we need to go into it, but the pandemic came and I bought land and so did my husband. We were not together. So as a single woman, I renovated my camper and I moved to this 40-acre parcel by the Grand Canyon. And I realized I was so vulnerable. Even though I like to camp and backpack and hike and stuff, I was not prepared to survive on my own. And I felt incredibly wild and free, but also scared. So I was out there and I made it 5 months on my own. And a friend of mine said, "Oh, I know an alpaca farmer in the area. He's also by himself. Do you want to meet?" And at first I said no. She gave him my contact info and I tried to resist because I wanted to build my own utopia and not get distracted in a relationship. Anyways, he offered to bring me some alpaca poop and I finally agreed to meet him. And then it was love at first sight. Literally, it altered my reality. When I first met him, my generator was down. I had no backup power. And again, I was like really feeling scared about what I was going to do, how I was going to make it, another couple weeks or whatever. And then we were inseparable from that moment on. So he actually started this alpaca farm in 2020. He had about 15 alpacas. And then I moved here. We bought our mentor's alpaca farm out in 2021. And then we became the largest farm overnight in Arizona. And then we've continued to expand to now being the largest farm in the Southwest. So I'm just saying that because it kind of discredits my husband a little bit because he did start this farm before meeting me. But we can see how the conversation flows. But truly, it's us being together that we've built everything on this farm because you're stronger together. One person alone, he had already made it through one winter on his own and he knew how hard it was. So then now us together, that's just how it goes. And I think that's very much how the pioneers made it is they stuck together with their families. They stuck together with their spouses. And then, the first ranches and stuff, those are multi-generational ranches, and some of them are still in business today, like the cattle rancher in this area. He's a third generation rancher and they own square miles of property, like huge amounts of land. But that's going back to when Arizona first subdivided this land and gave it out to ranchers.
Yeah. Well, like you said, I mean, there's so many skills that are passed down and then that community, you're right. I mean, to try to make it on your own, you can do it in a city, but although you're still dependent on all of society. At least when you're living that lifestyle that you're talking about, you know who you're relying on. You have those bonds, those personal bonds. You know people by name and by face.
So, I mean, it's like, oh, I was a feminist when I lived in the city and I didn't want to depend on a man. And somehow that convinced me that I can make it out in nature when truly this lifestyle, you need to be partnered.
That's so
Only women are going
interesting.
to get so mad at hearing me say that. But it's true. Like, have you ever swung a splitting maul to split wood. I thought I was going to be splitting wood. I was delusional. I want
That's a great point. And I guess anybody, whatever, wherever your background, whatever, everybody probably finds that they have these weaknesses that somebody
Yeah.
else can complement.
Right. So, like, from my husband's perspective, he would have never worked with a fiber. He would have never have monetized in an art-centered business. It would be sitting in the carport, right? Or maybe he would have given it away or sold it off for cheap. But so in a lot of ways, I feel like I brought like the soul, the beauty, the magic to the farm. Whereas for him, it was just straight ranching, just animal sales, you know?
I was wondering, and you don't have to share anything if it's too personal, but just like generally, when you go back to your decision to live off grid, even before you met your husband, what do you want to share at all? Like what was the impulse, or what was the desire or the fear or both that made you think, okay, I want to live this way?
Well, I was a brand new yoga studio owner. We opened my daughter and I as business partners. So I was a teen mom. I had my girls young. So my older daughter and I, we opened a yoga studio together. Our opening date was February 1st, 2020. So by mid-March, the pandemic came and our state was fo forced to close. And I was like, and I'm a practicing astrologer as well. And I saw the writing on the wall. I was like, okay, so we're not going to make it. There's no way we're going to make it. So I reached out to our landlord for the building and I said, can you please let me out of my lease? I don't know what to do. And he agreed that we were in trouble and that we weren't going to make it. And he let me out of the lease. No fees, no nothing. All he wanted me to do was paint over the mural that we did on the wall. Because we renovated, we painted, we did flooring, we ripped shit apart, you know. So I had to walk away from all of that, but I had some money to help us make it through the studio or through our opening time, you know. I took that money and I bought land. So my daughter and I, we originally thought that we would lead camping retreats, yoga retreats out on the land. And we both went to permaculture design school. So by June 2020, we had already bought our parcel and we were in permaculture design school together. So are you familiar with permaculture design?
A little bit. Yeah, I've researched it just for my own uses around here, but tell me about it.
So I mean it's a way to merge your human reality with the ecosystems that surround you. So, you know, harvesting rainwater, composting, you know, those would be seen as permaculture design practices, but they have a whole set of principles. And basically, you do everything you can to create zero waste. So wastes are seen as resources. So you have to transform your perspective and reintegrate waste as resources into your reality. I mean, that's how I perceive it. To me, as a woman who's mystical and spiritual, I saw permaculture design as a way to worship the earth in a very practical, mundane way. So before my spiritual practices were, you know, ungrounded. You know, like I told you, I was doing a lot of plant medicine, doing a lot of yoga. All I cared about was the development of my consciousness. I wasn't actually using my free will to tend the earth. And now that is my spiritual practice. This whole farm is my altar. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, it totally
Okay.
does. Yeah, I had been a little bit familiar with it, but when I lived in town, it was something that was sort of, I guess I had some notions about what it was. And then since moving to a rural area, high elevation, it's a harsh climate. There's not a lot of water. It's like, okay, I mean, there's all these functional benefits too, besides what you just talked about, which is just that kind of mystical connection with the earth, getting your hands and your feet in the dirt. But it's like, oh, that's why people do it too, is that you have to, depending on where you live.
Right. So permaculture design is actually indigenous wisdom. You know, I mean, if you look at the creator, people do say that he traveled to indigenous, populations and he learned what they were doing. So, like when the earliest, European, colonies came here, the indigenous people were actually practicing permaculture design. You know, they were doing prescribed burns, they were stewarding the forest, and it was a garden. It wasn't just a wild space that had not been tamed or been cared for.
So since we're on that topic, do you want to talk a little bit about, in a little bit more detail, about what kind of permaculture you practice in your landscape, and describe what your landscape is, by the way, in northern Arizona? I looked at
Sure.
some pictures on your website, but maybe you can share some
Yeah.
additional details.
So our landscape here, we're at about 6,000 feet elevation. We're in a rich juniper forest. We have 47 acres of land that we steward. This is Havasupai territory in northern Arizona. So we have about, I would say, 30 acres is dense juniper forest, and about the rest is prairie. So we are blessed to have grazing land as well as forest on our property. We have tons of wildlife, anything that you can imagine, from snakes to mountain lions, coyotes, groundhogs, butterflies, everything we get to experience here, and we get to experience it on a regular basis. I know before I moved off grid, I was always seeking out nature. I was always seeking out experiences with wildlife or an animal encounter on a hike or a camping trip. And now it's just become a daily reality. Oh,
So
and antelope and elk are also very abundant.
how much water or rainfall or snowfall do you typically get? What's that look like?
Sure. So annual rainfall for our region is 16 inches on average, with about 8 inches coming every monsoon season. So we've experienced extreme flooding on our property 2 years in a row, and then now we've had extreme drought for 2 years in a row. My first two winters off grid were extremely harsh. We had so much snow, and I can't remember right now. We do have a weather station, so we measure everything and keep logs, so we can kind of observe and establish patterns to better know what to expect. In permaculture design, they say you need to observe your land for one full year so that you can see all four seasons and what they bring to you before doing any building. But we've experienced bigger patterns that one year wouldn't have ever even revealed it to you, you know. So 2 years we had massive flooding. So our property kind of starts like this, and it comes down into a basin. So our swale, the flow of water, we have a seasonal stream that runs lengthwise through our property, and we have a pond that my husband dug with the tractor. Now, when he dug that pond, he actually hit a clay vein. So that's a little bit off topic in regards to the landscape, but that clay has become a very valuable resource because we've used it in building our earthen structures for the animals. So we had flooding our first year. Millions and millions of gallons of water flowing through here like nothing I ever experienced before. Then the second year, massive flooding again. Our monsoon season, I believe Arizona in 2022 and no, 2021 and 2022, I believe we had record-breaking monsoon seasons. So our second year of flooding, we had already expanded the herd, and our alpacas were actually up to their knees in water. It was terrifying. So we had to set up some emergency structures and higher ground and make sure that we had a safe place to move the animals back and forth to. And we were scared. We breed animals. We were worried about our mamas losing their babies and stuff like that. Luckily, none of that happened and everybody was okay. But it definitely makes you feel so vulnerable when you're in flood waters. And I mean, we couldn't even get to our doorstep here. We had to jump on the quad. We had to pull the quad up to the door and go from the quad inside. So, like I said, we had two huge monsoon seasons and then 2 years of snow. So then when the snow melted, spring, that'd be 2023. We had massive flooding in spring. We had two trucks, because you always got to have a backup of every single tool and vehicle. So we had two trucks get stuck right outside our property line. And my husband had to, I think he pulled with a tractor, and I was giving it gas inside. And I think we had to put some things underneath the tires and stuff like that to get the vehicles out, but we couldn't leave. So there's basically, I think we went 10 days or 2 weeks or so, where we were just, we couldn't leave.
Wow.
And since then, my husband's actually developed the swale. He's done so. In permaculture, you also learn about earthworks and working with moving earth to dig ditches and stuff like that, so you can manage the flow of water. So he did that after the 2 years of flooding. He made a lot of adjustments to the pond and to the swale, and then they've never filled again. So we don't even know how well they're going to operate. So we're hoping that the rains come back this year. Now we monitor our surrounding landscape as well, right? We're not just learning from our 47 acres. We're learning from the entirety of the forest that surrounds us. So there's a huge mountain to the west. I call it the Grandmother Mountain, and we've tracked the water. So the water sheds off the mountain. So the Our flooding doesn't come just from the rainfall here. It comes from water shedding this from the surrounding landscape. Starting with that mountain, it sheds down the mountain and it eventually ends up in what we call the dry lake now. That lake overflows and then the water travels 80 acres before it enters our parcel. So we would be at risk, I guess you could say, if somebody actually moved onto that land above us and stopped the flow of water before it hits our property. So we do hope to acquire more land if anybody decides to ever sell, because nobody lives out here. They're just people have bought the land as an investment, who knows how many years ago, but they never come out here. So hopefully someday they'll sell and we'll acquire those parcels that would impact the flow of water to our land.
So you're thinking just like the settlers did years ago, or any frontiers people. I mean, you really have to start local right next to you, and then you're thinking in sort of circles outwards, and how the landscape and the wider environment and climate affects your day-to-day living. You really have to be aware of all of that. As far as water use, so the water that flows to your property, the animals can drink that. How do you use that water for drinking and everything else you need it for?
Drinking and washing. Yeah, so for the 2 years that we had good monsoons, we actually made it an entire year without having to haul water at all. So when we don't get a lot of rain, we have to haul water from a local well, which that also poses a risk. So we have to pay for that water. And when that well goes down, we have to find someplace else to get water. And water is a commodity in our country. It's not a right, right? So we made it a year without having to haul water at all. We had enough for our herd and us. So I think back then we probably had about 40 alpacas. Now, since then, we've had to haul water for the herd, but we continue to have enough water for us. So on our living shelter, this structure that I'm in right now, we have 2 3,000 gallon tanks. So we have a double pitch roof. So we have a tank on each side. This side of the structure has a big carport. So we actually harvest more off of this side than the other side. But I think we have maybe 1,100 or 1,300 square feet of roof space. And then the way the math works with harvesting rainwater is off of 1 inch of rain per square foot of roof space, you get about 0.61 gallons of rainwater. Now, plus or minus, depending what happens in the storm, right? So if you get an inch of rain in 10 minutes during some insane monsoon season, the gutters overflow. So you're going to have some loss. And then you also want to be managing your overflow and where the overflow valve, is going, right? So you don't want to waste water. So again, that would be creating waste rather than resource. So we have to send our overflow valves towards the garden or towards the pond, which this tank goes towards the garden, that tank goes towards the pond. So we're not losing that water. Now, once our pond gets water again, we can give the animals the water straight from the pond. Or we can pump that. If we had a larger storage tank, we could pump it immediately and put it in a storage tank. So harvesting rainwater isn't just about the capacity that you can catch at the time of the storm. You have to constantly be moving that rainwater to create space in your rain tanks. So when our tanks fill up, my husband has to pump it to a large, we have a big galvanized steel tank or whatever it is. We pump the water over to that tank, and that's where we store it long term. So we drink it, we shower in it. It's the best feeling ever. I feel like you can tell that it's nitrogen-rich water. So I love to soak in it.
Did you
Just like
design your
a.
buildings? I'm
Go
sorry.
ahead.
Did you design your buildings, from the beginning with all this in mind, or did you start, get your buildings up, and then your goals change, and then you had to modify? How forward
Yeah.
looking were you at the beginning of this?
So my husband and I have different lenses for the landscape because he was a commercial landscape contractor. So he has a ton of experience moving earth and designing beautiful landscapes. But I came into this off-grid reality with permaculture design as my perspective. So take this structure, for example, that we live in now. He did not design this to be a living shelter. He actually owned a yoga studio as well. And the pandemic came and he thought that this would be used for yoga retreats. So it's got a vaulted ceiling. I mean, this has like, I think our chimney in here is 16 feet tall. When you're building something, a shelter, you want it to be super efficient. So when you have vaulted ceilings like this and some other things, he just didn't take that into account because he thought that this would just be a retreat center type of thing. So we do hope to build a living shelter. His plan is to have our shelter built within 2 years, where it'll be a combination of different earthen techniques. We're really drawn to stone masonry, and then we're also drawn to cob. And we've experienced because we built two animal barns using some different earthen technologies. And out of, earth bags, straw bale, and I did some work with pallets. We like cob the best. Cob is the OG. It sustains. Are you familiar with cob?
No, I was just going to ask you, what is Cobb?
Cob is a combination of clay and sand mixed with straw. And then you actually sculpt the structure and it becomes one monolithic structure. I absolutely love it. So I went through a phase, I don't know, maybe 5 or 8 years ago or something, where I really was drawn to studying ancient architecture and ancient civilizations and, yeah, monolithic structures and everything like that. And to me, Cobb is just that because it becomes one monolithic structure. It's a solid thing, and you can sculpt your designs in it. So like on our cob barns, we've sculpted sheep, we did a sun, we've got a grain of corn growing from the land. And I feel like someday, some people in the future, let's say something catastrophic happens to Earth and some future people find our farm, they're going to be like, who were these indigenous people living on this land? It was me. It was me sculpting with the clay and putting these symbols in our buildings and things like that.
Are all those materials available on your property, or do you have to harvest those elsewhere? And then what are some of the other benefits of using cob? Like, I'm thinking probably there's some insulating effects
Yeah,
and.
so there's thermal mass, right? So, cob walls, they can be 12 inches, 18 inches thick, whatever thickness you want to make them. So they're going to stay super cool during the summertime, and then they'll stay warm during the winter. There's other benefits too, just like sound. They're so quiet. It's like being in a cave. I don't know if you've ever been into, in this region, the indigenous people, as well as I feel like in my Swedish ancestry, people were building pit houses where you go down into the structure. And I've actually been in one of those before, and it is so quiet. It's very similar to being in a cob structure where there's no sound. And then the cob, it's part of the ecosystem. It's living. It breathes, and it holds moisture, but then it dries out naturally in a way that it doesn't crack. But you do have to maintain earthen structures. That's the thing, and that's probably why it's not practiced anymore, is because you have to regularly apply plaster and maintain them. And then you asked if we harvest the materials from the land. We harvest everything from the land except for the straw. And straw actually has gotten kind of expensive. I think we pay $13 a bale for straw, which is just like a waste product anyways, but yeah, we have to buy it. So that's the one product that we do buy. The clay, like I mentioned earlier, when my husband was digging the pond, he hit a clay vein. The clay in our region is, or the soil in our region is more clay-ish, but you can clearly see the difference from where he hit that clay vein compared to the regular soil. I mean, it's pure clay. And then the sand we get, so remember I told you the flow of water comes. And during the flooding, we had those 2 years in a row, massive amounts of sand came from somewhere. So we've harvested a lot of sand. So we have to go out there with a dump trailer and the tractor and get a bunch of loads of sand. And then when you're building these structures, you also have to sift the sand. So it's a long process, and that's my husband's struggle in the beginning. Is he's a builder. He's been building and doing most things himself, like additions and renovating and stuff since his 20s, you know, and he's in his 50s now. So learning to move at a slower pace with natural building was definitely, I don't know, a little bit of growth for him that he had to go through, because it's not, you're not going to put a wall up in a day, right? You have to sift the sand, you have to get out all the pebbles. And if there's clay in there, you know, then that's going to affect your clay sand ratio. So then you have to do some experimenting and figure out exactly what the sand clay ratio needs to be so it doesn't crack and it stays together. If you have too much clay, it's going to crack. So the straw acts like a binder holding it together.
How much of this did you know at the outset when you were looking at the property? Because it sounds like the way you're describing this, you have some really important elements or characteristics of your property. Like, I don't have running water on my property. I wish I did. I have a well, and it would be great to have running water. But how much of this were you able to size up, and your husband were able to look at and say, okay, we have water, we have sand, we have this kind of soil characterization? Or did you just figure this out as you went?
Well, I learned a lot of it through permaculture design. So when I did my permaculture design program, it was in 2020 and nobody was meeting in person. So I actually had to learn about natural building and soil and all kinds of stuff, very earth-based, through this online portal. So I didn't get any hands-on experience until we were out here on the land. And it's a lot of exploration, right? So you call yourself an explorer. I mean, there's new discoveries and explorations around every single corner out here. So it was a lot of that. I mean, I was looking for everything when I first came out here. I wanted to find an aquifer, you know, or a spring. So I was constantly looking for resources.
That's awesome.
And you don't see everything at first either. I don't know if it's like you don't see the forest for the trees or whatever that saying is, but you don't see everything on your first walk. You know, nature is slowly revealing herself to you. It's part of the great mystery. And when you need that resource or that tool, she reveals it to you.
So is there any typical day in your life? I mean, I'm sure there's farm ranch chores, and there are certain things that you have to do because you're off grid, but you also have a lot of different projects that you're working on. You're also always discovering
Yeah.
new ways and new features of your land. For folks who are not at all familiar with this lifestyle, do you want to describe like just a typical day?
A typical day. So my husband and I are early birds. Like, we're the earliest birds. So we wake up at 4 every day. That's just how our clocks naturally work. And luckily, we're both the same in that way. For some reason, we just naturally wake up at 4 a.m. We start, well, I drink water first, but then we have our coffee together and kind of talk about whatever's going on. My husband does his yoga in the morning. I do my yoga in the afternoon. So after our coffee, typically I start making art. Whatever project I didn't get finished the day before, I right away start working on in the morning. I love working on art. before the sun is up. I don't know how to explain it, but that's always been my most mystical time of the day for me is pre-dawn. So I'm working on my art, he's doing his yoga, and then we have our morning chores that we start at sunrise. So I used to do all of the sheep chores. I'm very bonded to my sheep. We don't sell the sheep, so they're just like my family. So I used to do all of the sheep chores and attend to the mama and babies. But since the art business has taken off and it's become lucrative and supportive for our farm, my husband has taken over all of the farm chores. which is great because it was actually really hard. I was so divided between the art and the chores and trying to manage it all. And then, I started doing art shows in Sedona. So during the tourist season, I'm going to Sedona every week to sell art on the weekends. So he is now doing all of the farm chores, and I'm mainly focusing on art. And when I go out, I get to just love on the animals. I do actually miss doing the chores because there's something so special about farming and working with animals. And I feel like for me, I get to experience unconditional love with the animals. It's like having a baby or a child where it's just so pure and untainted. And that's what I get to experience with the animals, even just raking their poop and they're hanging out by my legs and stuff. I love the companionship and the relationship that I have with the animals. So after morning chores, Dave will have a project that he's working on, right? So there's always projects on the farm. He is never like, oh, I have a day off or something. That's doesn't exist. So like right now he's working on he's building a new fiber studio because I do all of the art in our living shelter, which is not good because fiber is really dirty, so we're always breathing in the dust and things like that. But we didn't expect when I first started learning from the fiber. Well, I guess let me rewind a second. Our intention was originally to send the fiber out to a mill to be processed. So we thought we would outsource it. And then after touring a mill and doing a ton of research, it didn't feel good in my soul as a permaculture designer because remember, the main thing with permaculture design is zero waste. So when you send your fiber out to a mill, you lose about 30 to 50% of your yield to waste. So a mill has commercial machines and there's a sequence, right? So the fiber goes through this sequence of machines and each machine has different requirements, right? And an animal doesn't produce 100% consistent fiber. It's not like each hair, on your beard is exactly the same. There's variabilities, So then the machines spit out those fibers that don't meet the requirements, and that, gets thrown, goes to a landfill or is incinerated or who knows what happens to it. Not to mention the waste or the soap. A lot of times the soap can be the most toxic thing in the process. So I came to the conclusion that I was going to have to learn how to do everything myself. And it began more like a hobby. And honestly, it began as I'm going to be a hat maker. That's how I'll make the art and support our farm is I'll sell hats. So I actually first learned how to hand spin yarn. Our alpaca mentor taught me how to spin, but then I started felting and it was game over. So I still spin yarn, but it's not my passion. I would much rather be felting every day. So that was now several years ago. And then just in this last year, we have finally started outsourcing because basically there is actually no way to scale your business as a hand maker, right? So I'm just one woman and I got some wholesale accounts in Sedona last summer. And I mean, I think I was making like 10 bucks an hour working all day long trying to mass produce purses and stuff for these boutiques. And it wasn't good for my health and it wasn't good for the art. So it was like, okay, so we have our fiber here that I will continue to focus on. And then we'll outsource some things to kind of meet the consumer where they're at. Because honestly, the consumer wants alpaca socks, right? I'm not here spinning fine yarn to knit an alpaca sock for somebody to pay 30 bucks for them. that it's not possible. So we do outsource some stuff now for commercially made products, just like this tank top I had made in Peru. Let's see, where was I going with this? Oh, so after learning how to do everything myself, I finally felt comfortable outsourcing. I was telling you about our chores. I totally lost track.
No, that's okay. That's okay. We can you can either continue with that or just finish up your day, and then I want to jump into all this alpaca stuff because this is really cool.
So Dave starts his projects after morning chores. Either building something or maintaining something, and that's a big part of our reality out here, is that every system has to be maintained. So troubleshooting why our solar isn't charging, or something's happening with a gutter for rainwater, or an animal is perhaps sick, right, and acting off, or maybe fencing is down, or maybe one of the rancher's cows got into our property over the perimeter fence and is trying to eat our grass. So there's never a day where something doesn't happen for him. After he does his projects during the day, then it's time to do water. So we didn't have running water on our farm. Literally, it was almost 3 years. We didn't even have running water in our shelter. So we had to carry water for every single need. And I would say that that was probably the biggest change for me, not to mention the isolation that comes without seeing other humans. But just having to carry water and be responsible for your water is a really big deal. And water is heavy, right? It's not light. And so we learned that it's actually easier to carry two buckets half full with each arm than one bucket really full and be walking all weird. So when it comes to watering the animals, we have a water trailer that can be pulled with one of the trucks or the tractor, and then a big long fire hose. And we use that fire hose also for pumping water as well from tank to tank. So he'll go around and do all of the water, he'll do the poop, and then it's time for afternoon feeding. And then it'll be 7 o'clock and time for bed, because we go to bed at 7 because we wake up at 4. So he's doing all of his projects and chores. Mostly I'm focusing on art, making products to sell, making things for myself, for my family, or just washing the fiber, right? One other thing that my husband did take over as well, since the art started really becoming successful, is now he cards the fiber for me. So that's like a dream come true. I'm sure if other fiber artists see this, to know that your husband cards all your fiber is a really big deal. So carding fiber is when you it's kind of like when you brush your hair and all of the hair goes in one direction. It's a lengthy, tedious project or process. So just for me to be able to make something, that fiber has to be carded first. So maybe it would take me 2 hours to card the fiber. Now I just get to go see, what does Dave have ready for me? What colors does he have? What blends? And I get to just choose the fiber and it's ready to go. So he supports the art tremendously behind the scenes in that way.
So you guys have really formulated a dance between the two of you just through this lifestyle. You figure out what you're each good at, what you're each interested in, and adjust. You were kind of starting at, if I heard you correctly, at a similar point where you're both moving into this off-grid lifestyle, or you're kind of right there. Before we get into the alpaca stuff, obviously you're really passionate about this and you're excited about it. And to anybody listening, they might think, well, that's a lot of work. I mean, but you love it, clearly. How has it changed you? I mean, I think there's some obvious ways that anybody can think about, but is there anything unexpected or that you've reflected back on and thought, wow, I really am different than I used to be as a result of this? And then on the flip side, what is it you dislike the most about it? Or what is like the chore, the aspect of this that's like, ah, if I could just get rid of that.
Yeah, I've changed so much. I don't know how I would ever live back in civilization. It's weird just to sit on a toilet, right? So like I I mentioned earlier, we compost our human waste. So basically, we go to the bathroom in a bucket and we take that bucket out to our humanure bin. Humanure is just what you call human waste when you're composting that to become fertile soil to grow food in the future. So we are truly one with nature because our wastes go out to the garden. It takes a year to compost, though. So you have to compost human waste for a year. When we first started this journey and I really started working with the fiber, I would never leave the farm. I wouldn't leave for 2 or 3 months. I was just isolated on my island making art all day long. It even infiltrated the dream world because I would be dreaming I was felting. So for me, going out into civilization, seeing a regular toilet, seeing water go down a mystical drain, you have no idea where it's going, you know? That's the weirdest thing ever. I can't even imagine just turning on a water and not knowing where the water is going. That's a big change for me. And then also, I just feel weirder and weirder being in stores, seeing all of this trash for sale, because everything is trash. You know, I mean, you go to the craft store to buy something you need for a craft or whatever. Those two aisles by the checkout line, they're just trash. You know, they're just seasonal items they're trying to get you to buy that will eventually end up in a landfill that will never break down. So in that way, like sometimes when I'm in stores, I feel like I'm an alien and I'm like the only person seeing that everything in this aisle is trash, you know? And not to mention that things are actually built in such a way that they do fall apart. I mean, that is a strategy that manufacturers have. They don't build things to last. They build them for you to use them a few times and throw them away and then buy something else. So my whole perspective when I do have to go out into civilization to a store or something like that, I feel like I'm just the weirdest one there. You know, I feel like I want to go squat outside and go to the bathroom, and I would probably be arrested. But, like, that's the most natural way, you know? And sometimes when I'm out in public places and there's no bathroom, I'm like, why? How is this even like, you know, like, this is not even natural that there's no bathrooms, there's no nature, there's nothing, you know, there's just all of these stores and trash all over the place. So, those are some of the changes that I've gone through. And, you know, some of the other big changes is just not having a sense of community. As a yoga teacher and somebody who is always in the classroom, or leading retreats, always in group settings, that was a big shift for me. And for the first year and a half or so, it was good. It was good to be isolated. It was good just to be Dave and I. That's my husband. Because we I mean, I guess you could say it's codependent or something, but we really learned how to be dependent on each other. So living out here like this, I mean, you have to be independent. You have to be able to troubleshoot and handle situations that you've never been in before. But at the same time, you have to be able to rely on your partner to show up, to be able to handle projects and the intensity as well. So for the first year and a half of us living out here, I mean, man, did we were so close. We learned so much. We grew so much together. But then after that, I really started missing community. I started getting more and more emotional, feeling more and more isolated. So I'm so grateful now to have found an art community so that I get to leave the farm. I get to be in an incredible community of artists in Sedona regularly, and then come back to my husband on the farm for the other time that I'm not gone. So that's been some of my biggest changes. Now, some things that on the farm here, I mean, as far as what I don't like, it's hard. It's hard. And I would be lying if I didn't say that there are times that we've thought about throwing in the towel. Like we actually negotiated to buy an on-grid farm last year. Last year, my husband was diagnosed with arthritis in his hands. I'm gonna cry. So I don't speak about it publicly. But it does affect his spirit and what he's capable of. Just give me 1 second. So, he has started working with a naturopath and doing some other things because there's a correlation with arthritis in the gut and changing your diet and doing some things to reduce inflammation. And then now it kind of waxes and wanes, and the more active he is with his hands, the more inflamed it becomes. So we actually thought last year, like, man, we gave it our best shot. We might have to throw in the towel. So we negotiated to buy a farm that was right off the highway, that was so accessible, had water, electricity, flushing toilets and all these things. And then we looked at the world and what is happening politically, globally, and we just thought, we've done all of this already. We've done all of this already. So now we're going to just say, well, we're going to move back out to where all these conveniences are when the world might be going to shit. We have no way of knowing. And spirit guided us to do this. We were guided from within to start an off-grid farm and do everything that we've done. So maybe spirit was preparing us for something that hasn't come yet, So we stuck it out and we're still here, and we've decided that this is going to be our lives for the rest of our time on Earth. So it is hard. It wears on us. The arthritis affects my husband's spirit, his positivity, and things like that when it's painful for him. So he's learning to move at a slower rate, which means everything will manifest slower for us because he has to take more time.
Yeah. The perspectives that you have and what you, the expectations that you have and the skills and the wisdom that you've developed. You and I met at that Graham Hancock conference. And for anybody who's not familiar with Graham Hancock, he talks about these ancient civilizations whose wisdom keepers may have passed along knowledge to following generations. And in a way, you're kind of like a, you're living kind of like a Viracocha sort of lifestyle where it's like a lot of people don't know how to do anything that you're talking about. And if the lights went out tomorrow, who's going to teach that? I mean, how is that going to be developed? It's just absent. So, I mean, you're living it really at kind of an extreme, and like a good way at that level, but even just like that general awareness of appreciating where the water comes from, and the water doesn't just suddenly appear in the toilet when you go to town. It's like all this has to work together, and true sustainability, meaning it's got to be like replicating or reproducing itself. It can't require more energy in than you're getting out. But that's just like an awareness that you have that's obviously pretty rare.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean it's definitely a type of awareness that we've earned, physically and psychologically. I mean, it's part of us now. There's no erasing it.
There's like a million other questions I could ask you, but I really want to kind of shift over to the alpacas and your artwork because you're obviously extremely talented. Not only are you doing all this ranch work, but in your background, you have some of your artwork that you've created. You talked a little bit about your hats. Do you want to jump into like why alpacas, why you like alpacas, what makes them special, and then how you use their fur and what you're creating and what your inspiration is around that. And then maybe you can show some of the stuff you've created because it's awesome. I bought a little purse when we were down in Sedona and I gave it to my wife and she loved it. But anyways, go ahead and explain that if you would.
Thank you. So for my husband, he always loved alpacas. He was always drawn to them, thought they were so cute and wanted to raise them. For me, I met the alpaca in Peru on a spiritual retreat, which was one of the main highlights of my life was visiting Peru. So the alpaca provides their human companions with this beautiful wool. It's comparable to perhaps merino wool or a sheep wool, but it's finer. So it's said to be silkier than cashmere, softer than cashmere, stronger than wool. It's a hollow fiber, so it's ultra light. Sheep fiber is a solid fiber, so it's not as light as alpaca fiber. So like my dreadlocks here. These are one of my staple products I sell in Sedona, these beautiful dreadlocks. These are so light because of the alpaca fiber. So it's like wearing nothing in your hair. These are temporary, it's just a hair tie that holds it in there. So it's for a vibe, not a commitment. So it's ultra light, it's ultra soft, it thermoregulates, so it keeps you warm during winter and cool during summer. But for me, as a felt maker, and felt making is something that did not come, it did not originate in Peru where the alpaca did. It actually originated in Central Asia and then spread out through Europe from there. So if you remember, the original Mongolian yurts were made from wool felt. So felting is the process of you take your raw fiber and you create friction and temperature changes, and it binds the fiber, it mats it up, creating an unwoven textile. I have studied it a ton because, like you, I am very much intrigued by the ancient past. So I believe that this was the very first textile that humans learned to make. They would have had access to animal fibers. They would have realized that friction matted the fibers up. And then they could have made all kinds of things from the fiber, from wearables to rugs to hats and shelters and anything. So let's see, where can I go with this? I spend most of my days felting, and it's a rigorous process. So my arms are very strong because I'm literally doing this all day long, matting up the fibers. This is one of my pieces. So I like to make wall art. I like to incorporate ancient symbols, symbols that we see in nature. So you can see this is the first eight spiral piece that I made here a few years ago. This is actually hand spun yarn that I used for the spirals in that design. And this is a piece I made right before the Graham Hancock event. So I have grown so much on my path to mastery as a felt maker. This is the nicest piece that I've made. I actually have a pair of boots on display right now in a museum. They were selected and they are so beautiful. Maybe I can give you a photo of those. But the boots that I made, I did a deerskin leather sole on them and I just can't wait to get them back so I can wear them.
That's beautiful. What inspires the designs that you choose?
Oh, this right here, the eight spiral design is re a reflection of Venus's orbit from Earth's perspective. It takes 8 Earth years for Venus to form a five-pointed star in the sky. So the five-pointed star and the spiral are also, both ancient symbols. Some people perceive the Venus orbit as making a five-petaled rose rather than a star. That's kind of like a Mary Magdalene thing. So it just depends on how you like to perceive the geometry that the planets are revealing to us. So most of my art is inspired by ancient art. So I do have some books on archaeology over here through a feminine perspective that talks about how in ancient civilizations, women were at the center of communities, and things like that. And ancient art was reflective of women's bodies. Like you see a lot of bulls, and they say the bull is a representation of the uterus. So I like to use what I've learned about ancient art and civilizations in my art, because ancient archaeology and art has influenced my consciousness, so therefore it's influenced the art that I make. So I do like a lot of kind of serpent type of stuff. This is a travel pouch for oracle cards here with a double spiral. So the double spiral can be seen as the life-sustaining power of breath. So I am a goddess worshiper. I like to worship the divine as seen as the woman or as the land. Let's see. Oh, this is one of my favorite pieces here. I thought for sure this would sell at the Graham Hancock event. I call this cosmic creation.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. And then this one here is Venus and the Moon. So,
So how
you
many alpaca, because you were telling me that all the alpaca have different colored fur. There's like a spectrum of colors. And I can't remember if you said that alpaca, like one animal, might have different fur colors, or if it's just among the different animals. How does that work?
So there's 16 natural colors of alpaca. And there are all kind of different shades of grays, browns, blacks, beige, white, fawn brown, and then you have the light, the medium, the dark within those colors. Usually alpacas are one solid color. Sometimes you get, especially with grays, you might get a white face or white legs. But you don't usually harvest that fiber for art. Oh, one of the things I didn't mention is that we use our waste fiber as a resource on our farm. So we don't throw any fiber out. It goes out to the garden as a mulch. So you can use fiber as either a surface mulch, so on top of the soil, it'll hold water, it'll insulate, it'll disperse that water slowly over time, which means you can water less, which is really important in our reality to be able to water less. And then you can also use it as a sheet mulch. If you're going to plant a garden, you can put fiber down first, then your soil, and then fiber on top of it. So the fiber, just like with the products that we make, it naturally breaks down and grows soil. It's not pollution. It's part of the ecosystem. The fiber also creates kind of, little tunnels and stuff like that for micro life and stuff to kind of feed on underneath the surface.
Did you figure that out yourself, or did you already know that?
I learned it after becoming a farmer that you can use the waste fiber in those ways. So, again, when I visited the mill, I had already learned these kinds of things, and they were wasting all of this fiber, and that's why it didn't feel good. Now, our big project that we did in spring 2024 was we built our earthen sheep barn. The earthen sheep barn I insulated completely with alpaca fiber. So, we have over 70 alpacas and about 20 sheep. So we are, predominantly an alpaca farm. I raised the sheep because it makes a better textile to blend the two animals together. My favorite blend is 50% alpaca, 50% sheep's wool. So my point is that we have an abundance of alpaca fiber and less sheep's wool. So over the couple of years, I had stocked up some waste fiber. So when we built this structure, we got free pallets actually from a plumber. So Dave went down with a trailer, hauled all these pallets up here. We stacked the pallets to form the wall, connecting them. And then I stuffed fiber into every single pallet. It took so much fiber. And then we cobbed it and plastered it around it. So we've used the fiber not only as the mulch, but also as an insulator.
That is so awesome. And you, again, I don't want to keep going sidetracked because I want you to show more of your stuff. So I'll just be quiet. Why don't you show more of the things that you've created here?
Well, what I'm really excited about is I am a first-time importer of Peruvian textiles. So, like I mentioned, I met the alpaca in Peru, and Peru is the motherland to the alpaca. The alpaca comes from the Andean region in South America. So the ancient indigenous people in this region started domesticating the alpaca, according to my studies. Graham Hancock may know something more, but about 5,000 years ago, maybe about the same time the sheep was being domesticated in Europe, the Peruvian people were domesticating the alpaca. The wild relative of the alpaca is the vicuna, right? The vicuna still lives in the wild in Peru. The alpacas are domesticated. They've never lived in the wild. So alpacas, as we know them, they're domesticated animals. They wouldn't survive without their human companions. It was really important in my heart that I figured out a way to honored the indigenous people that stewarded this animal into reality. The alpaca would not be here if those people were not shepherding those animals and strategically breeding them for the fiber and the characteristics that we love them for. So, after actually hitting quite a few blocks in the US, trying to have natural clothing made, the US is not a manufacturing type of country currently. Now that might change, I don't know, but it's actually really hard on a commercial scale to get things made, even as a large farm. So I hit block after block, and I didn't know what to do when it came time for us to, like I said, scale up because I can't make everything by hand, right? So after hitting some blocks, and actually, this tank top I originally was having made in New York. And some things happened and it was feeling out of alignment. And I pulled the project and I was like, I'm gonna see what it takes to actually work with Peruvian people. So I started doing research. I started having some Zoom calls with some people down there. And I found a group of women that focuses on employing women that are 50 and up. So older women that have traditional knitting skills, and this tank top came into reality. I have had nothing but the best experience working with these women. We communicate all day, every day on WhatsApp. I believe they are honest, they have integrity, and Peru is one of the knitting capitals in the world. This is what they do. A big part of their economy and culture revolves around the alpaca and their specialty cottons that they grow. So when we look at our country, there's not a lot of sustainable measures being taken in the factories that exist, which there's not that many. It's not something that's really talked about. You can't, it's just not there. But in Peru, there's so many certifications. There's so many things that they're doing. For one thing, they have a sacred connection with the land and animals. That's part of their heritage. And then being sustainable also comes more naturally to them. And it's also just better business practice. So I felt really good going that route. So yes, I am the girl that became an importer during a tariff war. So I've been learning a lot about working with another country, creating a global collaboration, and importing this product back to the US, which I mentioned it before our call, or before this started officially, that I had a lot of issues with customs when this product was coming in. It actually sat at customs for about 2 weeks. I was falsely charged a tariff. I've never gotten a refund, and there was nothing I could do about it. Nobody cared. I was completely disempowered in the situation. Peru has had a free trade agreement with the US since 2009. So there was no tariffs. And then the president gave them a 10% tariff. And then they were put on pause, and then I was still charged a tariff, and nobody cared. And there was nothing I can do about it. I requested a refund. My husband and I decided to pay the tariff because they were telling us they were going to ship our product back to Peru. And meanwhile, the whole time we were paying for storage. So that was my first import situation. Anyways, the tank tops turned out so good. So I've got them in black and beige. And these were made by women in Peru. So it's got a V-neck in the front and a deeper V in the back. And it's got a scoop in the back that goes a little bit lower than the front. This is actually a blend of a Peruvian specialty cotton called Tangas cotton. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Tangas cotton and baby alpaca. So the reason why I did a blend with cotton is I wanted this to be a summery type of tank top. Here in Arizona, where I sell most of our products, it's obviously a warmer climate. So sometimes people approach me when I'm out at the art shows and they say, "Oh, I could never wear that. It's too hot here." And they give me some reason of why they can't even look at our products, right? Because we think woolly items are just meant to keep us warm. So I wanted to overcome that challenge in our region by creating something that is totally natural, totally of the earth, sustainably made by women, that the alpaca is indigenous to that region, that could serve this climate and area. So I love it. As you can tell, it's super beautiful, super comfortable, lightweight, breathable, and I'm actually super proud of this product and what I went through to make it manifest.
A lot of the synthetic stuff that people buy, I mean, there's all these reasons why alpaca is probably superior to that, but how does it hold up compared to the, the synthetic stuff? And how do you treat it or
Yes.
care for it?
So good question. So first of all, synthetic fibers are not sustainable. They never break down. They stay in the landfills forever. And I don't know if you've seen videos of how fast fashion is being sent to other countries. It's ending up in their oceans and stuff like that. So we're not even managing the fast fashion at all appropriately. It's actually a huge source of pollution, second only to I think the oil industry or something like that. So fast fashion, synthetic fibers, they're not compatible with our bodies. So, we're part of nature. Our skin is permeable. It's not a solid barrier, so that's an illusion. So we're always absorbing what's on our bodies all the time. So kind of like how you think how the garden has mulch on top of it, clothing is like the mulch for our bodies. It's how we are filtering what's in our environment and what's coming through to our skin. So we're actually polluting our own bodies all the time by having those synthetic fibers, and it affects our fertility and all kinds of stuff with our hormones. So alpaca is totally natural. It has a high frequency. The human body has a frequency of 100. Alpaca or wool has a frequency of 5,000. So naturally, it uplifts your spirit. It's good for your overall well-being. And let's see, what else can I say about it? Oh, synthetic fibers make us stink. So you know how your feet smell, or you get body odor or whatever? That's because those fibers are not compatible with our nature. You don't get body odor when you're wearing natural fibers. You can wear your alpaca socks for days, and I've worn them for days, and your feet will never stink. I've also sold a lot of our socks, believe it or not. I don't mean that to be an insult, but men are some of my biggest customers. They're a little bit ahead of the curve when it comes to women as far as natural fibers go, because they see the purpose. They see that, oh, this is natural. It doesn't make me stink. I can wear it for many days and it lasts. It stands the test of time. It might be expensive, but I'm going to have it for forever. Women have been conditioned to be the number one consumer, right? We have to be shopping all the time with the latest trends, have the hottest fashion and style. So we, as women, are the ones that are creating all of this pollution, which is really sad. So a tank top like this is, it's an investment, right? I sell them for $129, but you will have it for many, many years to come. And rest assured, it will break down and grow soil. So like I mentioned earlier, we have less and less organic matter on our planet, less and less soil to grow food. This will actually break down and become soil. So it's part of the ecosystem, just like we are naturally part of the ecosystem. We're not separate. I think I did. I answered that. Okay, let me think. Is there anything else I want to say about alpaca? Oh, alpaca is also naturally more breathable than synthetic fibers. Synthetic fibers make you sweat more. They're not breathable. So like if your bedding is synthetic, you like your sheets, your blankets and stuff, which it probably is 100% polyester, you're going to sweat more at night than you would in some kind of organic natural bedding, just like you would in a natural clothing as well.
Oh, I totally believe you. Like a lot of the sports clothes are synthetics, and I notice like working out or exercising or whatever, cotton versus the synthetics, they stink and fast too. I mean, it doesn't take
Yeah.
long.
Like all of the yoga clothing. So, I mean, I spent a decade at least wearing nothing but Lululemon. You do a handful of sweaty classes, your yoga clothes get that smell and it never comes out. That's because that's made from plastic. So, we're actually wearing plastic. You're not wearing something natural, which is actually really disappointing for yoga communities and spiritual communities that, want to be connected and spiritual, but they're actually creating pollution through that habit.
Yeah, and I feel I have kids, and so I feel like when we throw out old clothes that there's really nothing wrong with them, but maybe they're too small or whatever else. I don't know, it eats at me for some reason, but the idea of just throwing it down in your garden and just having it break down naturally, if it was alpaca or something, a natural fiber, that would be that'd be awesome. I mean, then you can carry on the use of it. It's still contributing to your life.
Right, it's so magical. I mean, that's creating a closed loop system, and that's something that we all need to be doing as humans, is closing loops. So closing loops are when you take responsibility for your waste, right? You're not like, oh, I'm just gonna throw this away and it goes out to the landfill. There's no throwing it away, right? It's just removed from your site. But if you can take re responsibility for your waste and reintegrate it as a resource, you're creating a closed loop. And that's how Mother Earth works. She's one living, breathing organism. She takes responsibility for all of her waste. So one thing's dying and decaying away, it becomes life, it becomes nourishment for another organism. Right? That's what you're doing when you recycle, when you compost and things like that. You're closing loops. You're acting like Mama Gaia, planet Earth.
Yeah,
And that's
that's
how
true.
our farm operates. The more we close loops on our farm, we use the alpaca poop as the soil biomass in our garden. We reuse our wastewater a second time to water our fruit trees. We're acting like Mama Gaia. We're acting like planet Earth. So our farm starts to act like one living, breathing organism where everything is supporting something else. Nothing operates independently.
That's so fascinating. And it's a lifestyle that truly contributes to like the true community too, because it's local. It has to be. You're having to work with people there that are locally. You're taking local responsibility. You and I, before we recorded, we were talking about all the crazy things in the world, and nobody can do anything about that individually, But it's like you can do something with your own life. You can live more responsibly. You can focus on the things that bring you, your own value and happiness. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're doing. So sorry, a little bit of a tangent, but yeah, you answered all the questions that I were going through my mind and more. So thank you.
Well, on that note, I just want to say this to anybody that's watching this is that it doesn't have to be ex as extreme as us, right? So you can start small, especially starting with your clothing. So more than 80% of what is in our closets is synthetic fiber. That is not a change that you can make overnight. You can do it over time, slowly waning down those synthetic fibers and increasing the natural fibers. Just give yourself grace and do it slowly. Take one step at a time. It doesn't have to happen overnight.
Maybe just start with like your favorite sweater or your favorite
Yeah.
hat that you can wear over and over.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to share any more of your products, or you have so much awesome art? I'm looking at those felts behind you, and the phrase that's going through my head is like when you look at sacred architecture, I remember one architect calls it built myth. Well, that seems like woven myth back there because there's so much symbolism. Do you want to talk about any of that?
I love that. So this is actually a water goddess. I was making this piece as Dave was installing our pump to pump rainwater into our house so we could have an indoor shower after almost 3 years of not having running water. It was my birthday month, so it was in February, and he was doing that for my big birthday present. He was giving me running water. And so I wanted to work with a water goddess and honor water during that process. And then actually, while I was working on this project and he was working on installing the pump, one of our sheep went into labor and gave birth to my favorite little lamb, Buttercup. And unfortunately, her mama rejected her, and so she became my bottle baby. And I moved her inside the house, and she lived inside with us for a month. Actually, we had a little lamb inside, and it was a highlight for me too. I actually adopted another lamb from another farm so that she would have a sister. So I had two tiny little bottle lambs, just a few days apart, living inside, working on this project while my husband was installing running water. So it is, mythological to think of a water goddess, but it's actually really practical, right?
No, it's totally, it goes back to that functional piece that you were talking about with the clothing. Like it's beautiful, but it's also really functional. It makes sense. And then in that piece, you have spirals. You have, is that a fish?
That's a fish, yeah, on her
Okay.
apron.
And then maybe, are those stars or those lizards?
To me, they were kind of like fish as well. I don't know if you're familiar with like the Pisces symbol, but it's like the two fish going in opposite direction. One is kind of returning to source and one is leaving source and so on. So they kind of are fish. And then the spirals, represent the flow of water. And then I like to try to do, recognize the pattern. So there's like three triangles, three lines, but that one has five, and that just looked better. So, I do my best to incorporate the symbols and make them as meaningful as I can. This one right here was inspired by a cremation vessel that had human remains in it that was found along, man, I can't remember the river in the old Yugoslavia. I have Slavic and Swedish ancestry, and felt making is indigenous to both those regions. So there was a cremation urn that was shaped like a woman's body. So, the woman's body is a reflection of life and death as our bodies cycle monthly, right? So a lot of times I feel like ancient art, depending who's studying that art, it can reflect cycles of life and death, and then that can be reflected through the woman's body. So we've got spirals on her skirt there, and then we've got the double spiral on the breast. But overall, you can see that that was a vase, and I just added what I wanted, kind of around it to accentuate it.
That's funny. As soon as you started talking, I was looking at that and thinking it looks like pottery work, like pottery designs.
Yeah, it was literally a vase. Now the image that I have in the book that I have it does look a little bit different, because I'm working with a totally different modality, but it's was a vase shaped like a woman's body.
That's so cool. Well, I don't know how much time you have. I don't want to go over, but one question I did want to ask is for folks who are li well, first of all, I want you to share, or we can come back to this, where listeners can find your products, because you have a beautiful website, you have YouTube videos. You were mentioning earlier that you're going to do some like instructional videos. So it's a your website is a great resource as well as a way to actually purchase your products. But I was wondering if you could talk just briefly to anybody who's listening to this and thinking, gosh, I want to do that, or I want to move to a more, maybe an off-grid or a more sustainable way of life. And those chores and those lifestyle tasks, those sound appealing to me. But I also need to somehow maybe make some money, or I don't know if I can swing it. Do you have any just general advice or
Sure.
recommendations?
What I would recommend, first of all, is going to permaculture design school. So I believe it's like a 72-hour program. I did it in like 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something like that. I did it through Earth Activist, I think it's called Earth Activist Organization. It's based in kind of North Central California, but there are lots of permaculture design programs out there. So I got certified, and that gave me the foundation. I had never really worked with land and animals before. Honestly, I never even had a garden before. So that gave me so much knowledge and so much tools to just kind of hit the ground running and come to this with that perspective. And then I would also suggest, in permaculture design, they always say start small, start small. Simple, small solutions are easier to sustain. So start small. Don't look at like the whole canvas. It might be overwhelming. So just start small where you can make the change. And then, as far as making a living, now we are blessed in this current day reality with satellite Wi-Fi. So we have Starlink. So you can still access the online portal to be able to sell things, to be able to advertise what you're doing on the land, even though maybe you're more remote like we are. So without social media and without having a website, we would have no way to make a living. Right. So we sell all of the art and we also sell alpacas. So we sell alpacas nationwide and people can, view our alpacas online. They can pick out a herd online and then my husband will travel and deliver them. We offer free long-term mentorship to anybody who starts a herd with us. So basically, you can call us 24/7 with any issue you're having on your farm, and we'll be there to support you. So a lot of people like to start their farms with pregnant mamas. Maybe they get, three pregnant females, and then they'll get to experience a birth and get to raise a baby on their own. And then they'll also have access to that fiber to make art. So I know I do, felt making, but there's a lot of knitters out there. There's a lot of crochet artists, and you can use their fiber for that as well. And you can make art and sell it. You can sell it in different online portals or go to the art shows like I do. For us, selling online, the art has been a much bigger challenge than being in person. So the online world, there's so much competition. There's so many choices, and our products are not cheap, right? That's just the way it goes. They're an investment. And it's not good for my mental health to, make a really low wage with what I'm doing here. It affects the quality of the art, quite honestly. I like to spend my time and make really, really nice stuff. So it is very competitive online, but when I'm in person at the shows, I kill it. I get to tell our story. I get to share our farm story and what we do out here. And people are really inspired by it. And that's what actually fills my heart up is being able to tell our farm story and have somebody be so inspired like you were and be like, wow, I want to support this farm and what they're doing. So I'm going to buy a product from them. And I really truly believe that's why we've been so successful in person.
Yeah, your inspiration and passion comes through, and you're just such an interesting person. And I knew, like, when we kept passing, or I kept passing, and I kept coming back, I was just, there was just something, your aura and the stuff you were selling. It was like, this is just really, I don't know, it just spoke to me. And then I'm glad I asked because I had no idea that you sold alpacas and did this mentorship program too. So all my wheels are spinning, like, okay, what am I going to go do next? I like that permaculture certification idea. But as far as like totally making the handmade stuff, you can't, you're not running a factory. And, but you've given listeners a lot of reasons why they may now want to go out if they're not already and purchase something that's handmade like you craft and all the value and functionality and beauty around it. It just seems like a special gift versus just going down to your local store and buying something that really doesn't have any history or meaning to you.
Yeah, you just triggered this memory of one of my favorite customers back in December, and him and his wife were doing an all natural Christmas. So even the ornaments on their tree, because I had made some ornaments, they were going to be natural. All of the gifts that they were giving were going to be natural that year. That could be someplace for people to start, just being like, I'm going to do all natural gifts this year. I know it's hard when you have kids because there's just so much plastic, but maybe you could do a little bit natural for the holiday season because there's so much trash produced every holiday season.
Yeah, totally. I don't know if it was the COVID years or what, but something changed in me where I just thought, like, really buying local and not just buying local, but buying handmade, buying from people that you know, it just seemed more real. Like, just it just felt more special. And so I'm totally digging that stuff. So
That's the
now that
soul.
I know you and I've talked with you, I'm gonna have to be buying some more of your stuff because that artwork is just I know exactly where I'd put that.
Thank you. I feel like what you're connecting to is the soul. I mean, the soul, my soul, the soul of the animals, the soul of the land. You don't get that when you're buying mass-produced, plasticky kind of products. There's no soul in it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I want you to share like where listeners or customers can find you online, and then maybe if you have any, if you want to share where you'll be in person, that's fine too, or just or anything else that we forgot to talk about that you wanted to touch on.
Sure. So you can shop our products online at sacredalpaca.com. And the reason why I call our art Sacred Alpaca is because of this dance, this ceremony that we are in with the land and animals, managing our ways, loving them, tending to their babies. Everything that we go through here on the farm is super sacred. And then as far as alpacas go, we are a fully operating alpaca ranch, so we do sell alpacas nationwide, and you can view our herd at premaalpacas.com. We have a beautiful herd that is so diverse in colors and age. So there's plenty of beauty to look at with the animals and the art.
And then folks should definitely check out your YouTube videos too, because those are really cool. And you've documented some of this process, some of your
Yeah.
history over the years.
We started our YouTube channel, I think it was maybe 2.5 years ago. I'm not sure, maybe 2 years ago. I don't know, but I spent a ton of time on there. There are different playlists. There's a handful of tutorials on there that are really good. And then you'll also get to experience you'll also get to experience our off-grid life through those vlog videos. As soon as Dave is finished building the fiber studio, I'm going to start back up doing regular tutorials so I can share this craft and get it out there into the world so other people can learn how to make felt.
And then you mentioned you regularly go to Sedona to sell. Are there
Yeah.
any events or upcoming in-person type things that you want listeners to know about, or should they just check your website for that?
Sure. So as far as upcoming in-person events go, I'll be at the Flagstaff Wool Festival May 31st through June 1st. That's an exceptional event because everybody will be selling fiber art. There's fiber workshops taking place all day, every day. And then I will be doing some Flagstaff markets called the Flagstaff Mountain Town Market. Those will be at City Hall in downtown Flagstaff. And then in September, my schedule will begin again in Sedona every week with the Oak Creek Arts and Crafts Show. I highly recommend the Oak Creek Arts and Crafts Show. So follow them on Instagram and on Facebook so you can see. The promoter that runs those shows, she actually manages three different locations in Sedona. So I could be at any of her three locations. And you have, artists like me. You have indigenous people that are native to this region selling their fine art, so jewelry, pottery, and people just you don't have access to their art. They're not selling it online. You actually have to find them at these art shows.
Man, Nicole, you are such an interesting person, multi-talented. I'm really glad that we connected down in Sedona, and this was so much fun. I really appreciate. There's like I'm gonna have to go back through and digest all this stuff you've shared. It's so interesting. Thank you for your willingness to come on and talk about this.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Andrew. I appreciate it. I'm glad we met.